All right. I wrapped the sheet around my middle and proceeded with as much dignity as I could toward my bunk in the crew's quarters. Nodon and several others of the crew were sitting around the common table when I got there. They leaped to their feet as I padded in, newfound respect shining in their eyes. I accepted their plaudits as graciously as I could while clutching the sheet to my waist with one hand, thinking to myself that being a hero of sorts was rather pleasant. Then I went to my bunk and slid the privacy screen shut. Six sets of coveralls and underwear were laid out neatly on the bunk, freshly laundered. They had even put out matching sets of slipper socks. A show of appreciation for my retrieving the escape pod? Or had Fuchs simply ordered them to do it? I dressed, and Nodon insisted on escorting me to the bridge. Amar Jagal was in the command chair. Fuchs was in his quarters, I was told. But when I went down the short stretch of passageway to his door, Marguerite was already heading toward me.
"We should inspect the pod," she said, her face somber.
I drew in a breath. "Yes, you're right."
"Are you up to it?"
"Of course," I lied. Every muscle and joint in my body still ached. My head felt as if it weighed 11 tons. My hands were stiff with the glossy artificial skin she had grafted onto them. The stuff felt like a pair of gloves that were just a half size too small. But I wanted to get to the pod. My heart was trip-hammering. Whatever was left of Alex must be in that big metal sphere, I knew. My brother. No, he wasn't my brother, not biologically. But he'd been my big brother all my life, and I couldn't think of him in any other way. What would be left of the Alex who'd loved and protected me for as long as I could remember? As we clambered down the ladder toward the cargo bay, Marguerite said,
"We'll have to put on spacesuits. He's pumped out all the air in the bay."
Surprised, I snapped, "Why?"
"Vacuum's clean," she replied. "He wanted as low a level of contamination as possible."
"Where is he, anyway?" I demanded. "Why isn't Fuchs here? Doesn't he care what's inside the pod?" She hesitated a heartbeat before replying.
"He's in his quarters, plotting our trajectory back into orbit. I told you that before."
"Still? How long does it take to plot a trajectory? The computer does all the work."
Marguerite answered simply, "He's working out the trajectory, and he said he doesn't want to be disturbed."
We got to the cargo bay level. There was a locker with 4 spacesuits alongside the bay's personnel hatch. As we began to pull on the suits, Marguerite said,
"Your flight in Hecate took a lot out of him, you know."
"Aha," I thought. Aloud, I said to Marguerite,
"So he's resting, then?"
Again that little hesitation. Then she said quietly,
"Yes, he's resting."
We checked each other's suits once we had buttoned up inside them, going down the checklist programmed into the computers built into the suit wrists. It seemed a bit odd, speaking through the radio to someone standing only a meter away, but the bubble helmets muffled our voices so much we would have had to shout to make ourselves heard. Once we went through the airlock and into the cargo bay, I saw what a battering poor old Hecate had endured. She sat lopsidedly on the deck, one landing skid and its support struts crumpled beneath her hull. The hull itself was scratched and dented, long gouges of metal torn away. I walked slowly around the ship, staring at the damage. The diving plane on her left side was simply gone, nothing there but an ugly gash where it should have been. That entire side was badly banged where she'd slammed against the boulder. I reached out and patted her pitted flank with a gloved hand. The ship had kept me alive, but she would never fly again.
"You're treating it as if it's alive,"
Marguerite's voice came through my earphones, sounding surprised. "You're damned right," I said, startling myself at how strong a bond I felt with this broken heap of metal. In the cargo bay's bright lighting, I could see Marguerite's face through the fishbowl helmet. She was smiling at me.
"She'll find a good home back on Earth," Marguerite said. "I'm sure the Smithsonian will want her for one of their museums."
I hadn't thought of that. The idea pleased me. Hecate had served us well. She deserved a dignified resting place. My walk around the battered little ship ended at the escape pod, still clutched in Hecate's mechanical arms. The sphere looked like some relic from a bygone century, heavy and crusted with hand grips, a single circular hatch, a cluster of rocket tubes here, a mini-forest of stubby antennas there. It was more than twice my height in diameter, solid and thick. No portholes anywhere that I could see. Marguerite pointed to a box-like metal contraption off by the far bulkhead.
"We'll have to get the portable airlock set onto the pod's hatch," she said.
Obviously, she had been thinking out this job step by step, while I had been wrapped up in the emotional turmoil of wondering what to expect once we looked inside. So we rolled up the portable airlock. The pod's hatch was too low to the deck for the airlock to connect against it.
"We'll have to move it," Marguerite said.
She went to the power cables stored against the cargo bay bulkhead while I climbed back into Hecate's cockpit. It seemed somehow roomier than before, even though the spacesuit I was wearing must have been almost as bulky as the heat protection suit I'd been in before. The control panel's plastic had not melted, as I'd thought. That must have been the effect of blurred eyesight and more than a little panic.
"Power's connected," Marguerite
reported as the control panel lit up before my eyes. Gingerly, I maneuvered the manipulator arms until the pod's hatch was lined up with the portable airlock. Then I shut down Hecate's systems, but not before I gave her control panel a gentle pat and whispered, "Good girl." I was getting positively maudlin, I thought, but it felt appropriate. It even felt good. Once I'd climbed out of Hecate, Marguerite and I connected the airlock to the hatch, then tested the seals to make certain that the air inside the pod would not escape into the cargo bay.
"I think we're ready to open the hatch," she said at last.
I nodded inside my helmet, my insides quivering. Handing me a small case of sensors, Marguerite said,
"These are to analyze the air inside the pod. I'll bring the other sensors with me."
"You know how to handle these," I said. "Why don't you bring them?"
"You should go first," she said.
Yes, I thought. She's right. Alex was my brother. It's my place to go in there first. Nodding again, I ducked into the coffin-sized airlock. I found myself licking my lips nervously. I saw that the indicator light was red. The airlock was already in vacuum, so that when I opened the pod's hatch, no contaminating atmosphere would mix with the air inside. I had to open the hatch manually, since we did not want to power up the pod's internal systems, and didn't even know if the systems would come online after more than 3 years of baking on the surface of Venus. The manual control was stiff, but the servo motors on my gloves and the arms of my suit multiplied my muscular strength by a factor of 5 or more. Slowly, grudgingly, the little wheel turned as I grunted and strained with both hands. The hatch cracked open. Inside my spacesuit, I couldn't feel the puff of air that must have sighed out into the airlock. "We'll pump it back into the pod afterward," I told myself. There wasn't room in the airlock to pull the hatch open all the way, but I swung it back enough for me to get into the pod. Picking up the sensor case, I lifted one booted foot and stepped over the sill of the circular hatch. It was very dark inside, of course. I switched on my helmet lamp and saw two bodies sprawled on the metal deck. No, not bodies, I immediately told myself. Spacesuits. Fully sealed spacesuits. The two people, whoever they were, had had enough time to get into their suits before the final disaster struck them. Both suits looked strangely crumpled, shriveled, as if the bodies inside them had melted away. More than 3 years in the roasting heat of Venus, I thought. The monomolecular fabric of the suits looked oddly gray, discolored. I understood why. They had been baking in the scorching heat of Venus for a long time. It was a wonder that the fabric hadn't burned up entirely, I thought. Their suits may have been filled with an Earth-normal mix of oxygen and nitrogen at first, but that searing heat would break down any organic molecule and force who knew what kind of hellish chemistry inside the suits. It would turn the suits into slow-cooking ovens. God, the enormity of their death agonies struck me like a hammer between my eyes. Baking to death, literally cooked inside their own suits. How long did it take? Did they undergo hours or days of that torture? Or, once they realized what they faced, did they cut off their airflow and asphyxiate themselves? There were tears in my eyes as I bent over awkwardly in my own suit to examine the names stenciled onto the suit's torsos. "L. Bogdashki," said the one closest to me. I had to step over it to read the other name. "A. Humphreys." It was Alex, or what was left of him.